its Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque for the fifth day in a row, as Israeli warplanes bombed several positions of Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip. At least 31 people are killed, many more are wounded, after a suicide bomber attacks a crowded Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif. And Russia captures Ukraine's key port city of Mariupol, the biggest city seized since the war began 8 weeks ago. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us.
Tensions across the occupied territories are getting worse by the hour, with Israeli forces stepping up their atrocities against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. At least 30 Palestinians have been wounded by rubber bullets inside the mosque compound, which is besieged by Israeli forces. The victims sustained injuries in the head and the neck. One person was transferred to the hospital with a rubber bullet to his back. Regime troops have been intensifying assaults on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including the worshippers who congregate at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the fasting month of Ramadan. Meanwhile, Palestinians have been launching operations to counter the Israeli violence. Over the past month, nearly two dozen Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in a spate of retaliatory attacks and confrontations with Israeli forces. Earlier, we were joined by our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil, who updated us on Israel's recent acts of violence in Al-Quds. Let's take a listen.
Well, we have to mention that it's for the fifth consecutive day Israeli settlers are raiding the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex with the protection of Israeli police officers. Immediately following the morning Fajr prayers, after Palestinians pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, Israeli forces storm and raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. They force the Palestinian worshippers out of the complex in order to bring Israeli settlers and allow them to desecrate the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, like what happened today. According to the officials, Palestinian officials in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, today alone over 700 Jewish settlers have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, of course protected by the Israeli forces.
Israeli aircraft have conducted new airstrikes on Palestinian resistance positions across the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel claims the attacks were launched in response to earlier rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian groups say that their air defenses have repelled the intruding Israeli aircraft. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon tells us more.
Israeli fighter jets and drones attacked training centers for Hamas's military wing, the Izzeddin Qassam Brigades. The first airstrikes took place in the center of the Gaza Strip, and about an hour later, another airstrike targeted also a training center for Hamas south of Gaza City. Attacks took place as the Israeli regime claimed that Palestinian resistance groups fired a rocket from the Gaza Strip towards the Israeli regime. The Palestinian resistance groups did not sit idle while the Israeli strikes were taking place. They fired heavy caliber machine guns towards the Israeli fighter jets, repelling them from the skies of Gaza. The Israeli regime Iron Dome missile interception system was triggered by heavy caliber bullets from Gaza, in another example of the failure of the multi-billion dollar Iron Dome system from detecting or differentiating between rockets or bullets from being fired from Gaza. In reaction to last night's Israeli airstrikes, Hamas's spokesman Hazem Qasim said that the Israeli strikes will not weaken the Palestinians, quite the opposite. It will make them more determined to fight for Al-Quds and to defend the Palestinian people.
Huge explosions yet again rock Afghanistan, leaving dozens of casualties in several major cities, including the capital, Kabul. A powerful bomb blast ripped through the largest Shia mosque in the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, killing over 30 people.
The bombing, which targeted a congregation of worshippers, also left dozens injured, many of whom are now in critical condition. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the bomb attack. In the city of Kunduz, authorities say that a blast left at least 4 people dead and 18 wounded. Also earlier, a roadside bomb went off in a Shia neighborhood in western Kabul, injuring 2 children. Thursday's explosions come 2 days after twin bombing in a Shia neighborhood of Kabul, killing 6 people. Well, Iran has condemned the bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's fourth largest city, Mazar-e-Sharif. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said targeting fasting worshippers in the holy month of Ramadan is an abhorrent act of terror. He said that Tehran is concerned over recent deadly blasts in various cities across Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Afghanistan has called for an investigation into, quote, systematic targeted attacks on mosques and schools. In Pakistan, Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has also condemned the, quote, heinous act of violence in Mazar-e-Sharif. Social media have been filled with grief and condemnations in the wake of bloody terror attacks targeting educational centers in the Afghan capital Kabul on Tuesday. Hashtag trending brings you some of those reactions.
Hey everyone, welcome to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. Afghanistan's capital city of Kabul had a bloody day of terror on Tuesday when 2 explosions targeted a boys' school in a Hazara Shia neighborhood. At least 6 people were killed and over 25 people were injured, most of them were teenagers, when the powerful explosions hit the public school in Kabul. And no group has yet claimed responsibility for the attacks, but they bear the hallmark of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. The bloodshed sparked a wave of condemnation on social media. Many expressed their solidarity with the Afghan people who continue to suffer from terrorist attacks. And now a lot of people are calling upon the acting Taliban government to take action to fix the security issues that continue to plague the nation. Our first tweet of the day comes from Roman Khan. A blast in a children's school in Kabul. This is an attack on complete humanity. Killing innocent people is a big sin. Oh God, whoever these killers are, destroy them. May the Afghan people live long. Curse be upon the killers again. We have a picture posted by W. Sayel. The price that our children pay for education is their blood. Truly some heart-wrenching imagery right here. Murtaza Mohammadi said, it is a crime to study. Girls are not allowed to go to school. Boys are killed at school. Targeted killings continue to take the lives of innocent people in west of Kabul. Hazaras remain the most vulnerable community in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the plight of Afghanistan's Hazara Shia Muslims came under the spotlight once again in the wake of the attacks. The community has long been subjected to targeted killings, terrorist attacks, and mass kidnappings. Some activists are now calling for global action to finally put an end to the plight of the Hazaras. Our next comment comes from Javad Khan Achakzai. He said, I strongly condemn the attacks in Kabul. Targeting the future of a country, its children and schools, is utmost heinous. It is the responsibility of the de facto authorities to protect the people of Afghanistan from violence and terror, no matter their age, gender, and beliefs. Kabul is truly bleeding. Aziz Angar said, like the previous history, regime changed, but Kabul bleeding hasn't. Poor innocents continue paying the price for illiterates' mentality. My heart is bleeding once again to see my brothers and sisters get killed. And over here we have a comment by Zahid Danish Waziri, which reads, may Allah save Afghans. Afghans need the world's attention. This war, violence, and terrorism must be stopped. Innocents, students were martyred and injured in the bomb blasts in Kabul. While some criticized the Taliban for failing to ensure security, others blamed the U.S.-led foreign forces and said that they once invaded Afghanistan under the guise of fighting terrorism and are now trying to create insecurity following their escape. Our next comment and tweet comes from Safi Rauf. Girls in Afghanistan are not allowed to go to school. Schools are being bombed. Children are starving. Women and men killed every day. Why is the world silent? Ruhila Harak said, the current attacks are the work of a vicious circle that has killed Afghans for 20 years in the name of terrorism, has now fled Afghanistan, and once again seeks to pave the way for ethnic warfare and gain its followers. Adnan Nanibi said the horrific attacks in Kabul targeting schools and educational centers are a grim reminder of the violent reality that Afghans are forced to live with. My heartfelt condolences to the families of the victims. The world cannot continue to ignore Afghanistan. Final comment comes from Habib Khan. Hazaras are the most progressive ethnic group in Afghanistan, and that is why the terrorists are constantly targeting them in schools, mosques, rallies, and stadiums. Hashtag Stop Hazara Genocide.
Britain's Parliament is set to vote on a motion to launch an investigation into whether the Prime Minister deliberately misled Parliament in his initial response to COVID lockdown breaches. A majority of parliamentarians must vote in favour of the motion for it to pass. If it passes, Prime Minister Boris Johnson will be referred to a special committee that will determine whether his conduct amounted to contempt. On Wednesday, Tory MPs scrambled to find a way to block or to delay the inquiry with an amendment. But in a surprising turn of events, they pulled the amendment over concerns about accusations of a cover-up. British police have already fined Johnson for breaking lockdown rules with illegal gatherings at his office and residence. The opposition has repeatedly called for his resignation over the so-called Partygate scandal. Fifty-seven days into the war in Ukraine, the strategic port city of Mariupol is now under the full control of Russian forces, apart from a steel factory that is under siege.
As for today, all of Mariupol is under the control of the Russian army, the People's Militia of the Donetsk People's Republic, and the Azovstal plant territory with the remnants of nationalists and foreign mercenaries is securely blockaded.
The Russian defense minister said more than 2,000 Ukrainian forces are currently in the industrial zone. Azovstal, the last Ukrainian stronghold in Mariupol, is a massive industrial factory where hundreds of troops and civilians have been holed up for the past few days. President Vladimir Putin has also hailed, in his own words, the successful liberation of Mariupol. He has, however, ordered the Russian military to cancel any plans to storm the besieged plant.
I consider the proposed storming of the industrial zone unnecessary. I order you to cancel it. This is in case where we must think. I mean, we always must think, but in this case, more so, about preserving the lives and health of our soldiers and officers.
Putin also said the remaining Ukrainian fighters in Azovstal who had not surrendered would be treated with respect and that medical assistance would be provided to the injured. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president's advisor, Oleksiy Arestovych, says that Moscow seeks to blockade the Azovstal steel plant since it cannot take it by force. Arestovych said the Russians have suffered considerable losses there and are physically incapable of taking over the industrial zone. Kyiv has called for a humanitarian corridor to be opened immediately, allowing civilians and wounded fighters to get out of the factory. The war in Ukraine not only shows no signs of ending, but seems to be prolonging. One of the reasons behind the war not ending anytime soon, the U.S. pumping arms into Ukraine. The most recent sale, another $800 million. Why is the U.S. keen on giving Ukraine so much in military aid? Russia has warned the U.S. and NATO against continuing to arm Ukraine.
The war in Ukraine is raging on. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is entering a new phase, which is focused on eastern Ukraine as the opposing troops remain locked in combat along a 300-mile front line. The Russian Defense Ministry has given the Ukrainian forces an ultimatum to lay down their arms. Ukraine has reached a preliminary agreement with Russia to evacuate civilians. But the United States and its allies seem to be determined to prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to announce within the coming days another military aid package for Ukraine about the same size as the $800 million one announced last week. It will include artillery systems, artillery rounds, armored personnel carriers, and unmanned coastal defense boats. It would bring the total U.S. military aid to Ukraine since the Russian military offensive in February to well over $3 billion U.S. dollars. Kyiv has called for additional weapons and support to stave off Moscow's new offensive in the eastern Donbas region, where Russian forces have been amassing after their withdrawal from the Ukrainian capital. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also said Canada would be sending heavy artillery and promised to provide more details.
The U.S. has so far provided over $3 billion in military equipment to Ukraine, and this figure is just under the Biden presidency. Recently, the U.K. doubled the number of its missiles given to Ukraine, totaling 10,000. Britain also provided 2.5 million items of weaponry and military equipment, amounting to more than £1.5 billion. Meanwhile, the number of deaths is going up as the military sales continue.
There are some reports that the U.S. is using the Ukraine conflict to prepare for wars against Russia and China. The U.S. military is training to fight in an environment heavily shaped by the Russian military campaign against Ukraine that was launched about 2 months ago. The purpose of this month's war game in California is to prepare for future wars against Russia and China. The report said the role players in the exercise at the Fort Irwin National Training Center in the Mojave Desert speak Russian. About 4,500 soldiers from the 2nd Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division are pitted against the fictional Devonian forces, the exercise's apparent stand-in for the Russians. The enemy fires rockets and missiles in the drill, all while using a sophisticated disinformation campaign to make false accusations against U.S. troops.
So I think that the United States, the U.S. corporations, the U.S. government, the officials within United States politics and economics have their head on straight enough to know that an open war with Russia is against their profit motive, is against their motive for world domination, because there simply would be no world left to dominate.
The U.S. has also warned China that it will face consequences if it helps Russia evade sanctions in its invasion of Ukraine. China has so far refrained from condemning Russia for the invasion and has said Moscow's legitimate security concerns should be taken seriously. There has also been growing tensions between Beijing and Washington and its allies in the Asia-Pacific region, including over Taiwan and the South China Sea. The Pentagon and U.S. lawmakers cited countering China in passing this year's $777.7 billion defense budget.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ramadan, the month of opportunities. In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, indeed we sent it down on the night of ordainment. What will make you understand what the night of ordainment is? The night of ordainment is better than 1,000 months. In it, the angels and the spirit descend by the leave of their Lord with every command. It is peaceful until the rising of the dawn. The night of Qadr or ordainment are in fact a ray of hope in the blessed month of Ramadan. They are the nights whose value and greatness cannot be measured. The bond of servants with their Lord began in the start of Ramadan, but it reaches its climax on these nights. As a matter of fact, the night of Qadr is one night, but according to the infallible successors of the Prophet, it has been hidden among the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights so that the faithful spend more time to appeal to Allah and spend more time to seek forgiveness from Him. Over six centuries after the birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, just when the ecclesiastical bigotry had stopped thinking and growth of sciences among the Christian communities, God ordained a new prophet to guide people. The first words that God revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, were the following. Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clinging mass. Read, and your Lord is the noblest, who taught by the pen, taught man what he did not know. This shows the high position of knowledge, learning, and thinking in Islam. The Noble Quran always calls on Muslims to apply reason and reflect on God's signs everywhere. The Quran clearly tells the people to think over different phenomena and believe through thinking rather than blind following. Ayah 242 of Surah Baqarah reads, "Thus does Allah clarify His signs to you so that you may apply reason." The word aql or intellect and its derivatives have been mentioned 49 times in the Quran. In all these cases, people and Muslims have been invited to think and use their intellect in the signs of God. The Prophet of Islam and his infallible successors, as the true interpreters of the Quran, used to emphasize on reasoning and thinking. They have said that thinking for 1 hour is better than worshipping for 60 or 70 years. The Prophet says, "Every good thing is recognized by intellect, and he who does not have intellect has no religion." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "God has placed intellect without mean desires in the angels, and has placed mean desires without intellect among animals. But in man, the intellect and mean desires have been combined. So, he whose intellect overcomes his mean desires, is superior to the angels. And he whose mean desires overcome his intellect, is inferior to animals." In this part of the program, we will speak about other things that nullify fasting. Injection of any medicine does not nullify fasting except those shots that are nutritious or invigorating. So, the kinds of injections which are done for numbing do not nullify fasting. In addition, injection of hepatitis B does not nullify fasting because it is hypodermic. Distilled water will nullify fasting if it is injected in the vessel, but if it is injected in the muscle, it will not nullify fasting. Blood injection will nullify fasting. However, usage of suppositories does not nullify fasting. But it is better not to have endoscopy in Ramadan, even if it does not carry anything into the stomach. As it was said before, giving enema nullifies fasting. Well, going back to the virtues of Ramadan, let us see what Imam Sadiq says on the fasting of this month. The Imam says, "Haven't you heard what Maryam, daughter of Imran, said? Indeed, I have vowed a fast for the All-Beneficent, so I will not speak to any human today." Maryam held a fast of silence. Thus, when you fast, keep your tongue from lying, close your eyes from indecent scenes. Do not quarrel with each other. Do not be jealous of one another. Do not backbite. Do not be angry with each other. Do not swear falsely. Refrain from difference with each other. Do not insult. Do not call one another with evil nicknames. Do not dispute with each other. Do not wrong one another. Do not be unwise. Do not be upset with each other. Do not be negligent of God's remembrance and ritual prayer." Once a man asked Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, to introduce God to him. The sixth Imam said, "Suppose that you're sailing on a ship and suddenly there is a strong storm. You are caught in the huge waves and you feel that none of the ships around can rescue you. Yet your heart is drawn toward a power which can rescue you. You ask him for help and know that he can rescue you. That reality is the compassionate and merciful God."
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masoud Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know? And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do, nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it doesn't. It's not really a kind of comprehensive look at this situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk, and of course his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him, and he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm. So it's, and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved, but some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masoud, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, as the film was about the franchised sort of youth, getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what it sort of tackled is that here, Islam, you know, it gives the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost. You
so
know.
You're saying there's multiple messages in this film?
It is, but yeah. I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and yeah. I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so remember is talking about his friend who's just gone and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which has been disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was... It was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys got. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
Atrocities at home. I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society. To first of all, to understand this phenomenon and then to address it if possible. And this is sort of did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and have nothing to do, and of the fact that they're, you know, I mean, they were saying that was. Group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing. You know, and I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look for vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and polluted. You know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police, because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family, because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He becomes fooled, like him. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where a Somali, young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what, you know, what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think, I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue resulting in one thing. You know, really, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world, and they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable thing to feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in a right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this, and the reality is that they're forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. You know, the elephant in the room is being ignored, and the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, you know, activists in a real sense for the right things, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, you know, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving a message that end justifies the means. You know, and that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, I mean, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and what they should do. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. You know, they're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's
a
merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive too during this thing. Like, I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, you know, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb and exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, you know, and I saw that it was wrong. Endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, you know, being tricked into this endless killing. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be... I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done anything illegal?
In the film, does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story,
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masu, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, it really is difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be... a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually... we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which... It's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages, Rich?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of their society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had, but then that's another film. So,
And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long and it raises many questions, but as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come up fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.